Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
This is a speaker meeting. Duncan will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Sarah, who will share her experience, strength, and hope. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to our Duncan.
Let's see if I can get this thing to work.
All right, can people hear me?
Yep.
Excellent.
All right, hello, I'm Duncan. I'm an alcoholic.
Duncan!
And my sobriety date is July 17th, 2010. And it's an honor and a privilege to speak at this meeting tonight. And hopefully I'll get this on eventually. So, let's see. So I was talking to my sponsor not too recently, but it just occurred to me. And he just wanted, I mentioned kind of how I drank. And he said, oh, you would have been one of those guys that we would have kicked out, you know, right away. Because, you know, I was one of those buzzkill drunks. The guy that got, you know, kind of blacked out drunk and picked fights with people and sucker punched his friends in the face with, you know, point blank range and, you know, and so I was this Jekyll and Hyde drunk, right? It was like night and day. And, when I drink and I just had this completely different personality and it wasn't long after I started drinking. I mean, obviously I didn't drink for, you know, decades, but, you know, as soon as I started drinking, you know, within months, I already had my trifecta of, you know, King Cobra, Four Loko, and E&J Brandy, and down to a science, and, you know, what I do is I'd leave school, which kind of became a venue to panhandle, you know. Initially I would study and kind of, and then eventually I just started panhandling on campus, and I'd make my way across the street, pick up my booze, and get drunk and sucker punch someone in the face. But yeah, I was one of those guys that just, you know, I had a friend and her, you know, her mom was kind of the enabling drunk who let people over, you know, minors over and get shit-faced and do what, excuse, I don't know if I can cuss, but get really,
yeah, you can.
Okay, you know, get really drunk and, you know, do a bunch of drugs and, you know, and you know, hopefully not get in trouble with the cops. And so I'd go over there and I'd be that guy that, you know, she'd invite me and then by the time, you know, I was blacked out, I was causing a ruckus, she'd say, you can't stay here, you gotta go somewhere else, you know. And this is an ongoing process, you know. I'd go like 6 miles to and from this house, and, you know, quite often I'd find myself, you know, I teleported from her house back home in a blackout, and that happened more often than not. So yeah, that's just kind of a brief drunkalogue. You know, I was one of those people, I would, you know, I'd pick up a drink and I could not tell where I would end up. I crossed that blackout threshold and sometimes I would be, you know, a few shots or a few drinks or whatever in and I'd black out. And sometimes, you know, I would drink indefinitely and I wouldn't black out. But the bottom line is when I started drinking, I didn't know at which point I would stop drinking. You know, I couldn't predict a number of drinks and meet that standard. And even if I, you know, were to do it once, there's a lot of doubt that I would have been able to do it twice in a row. So, you know, my life, my family life kind of took a backseat. You know, I'm the oldest of 6 kids. You know, I turned into this monster. My family didn't really, they wanted me around, but I just couldn't be around, you know? And when I would come in after these benders where I disappear for a couple days, I do the tail between my legs, walk of shame up the front walkway, and get this disgusted but brokenhearted look from them, and then I do it again, you know, once I, you know, had enough energy in me to go out and do it again. And, yeah, I still remember one night being blacked out, and I'd sucker punch my friend in the face, and he beat me up, and I was bleeding, and my brother was crying, my youngest brother, and I didn't know what to do. I remember I was drunk, and I felt terrible, and I was coming out of this blackout, and I'm trying to comfort him, and I don't know if I caused him to cry or if he was already crying or what. But that's just how it started to look, you know, at my house. And eventually, I evicted myself from the house, and, you know, they gave me an ultimatum. You know, either you go back to treatment, because I've been through a few times, or you can continue to drink, but not under this roof, you know. And so that's what I chose to do. I moved out. I got a spot, you know, it was my Ford Taurus station wagon. And that lasted about a month before I crashed my car into another car in a blackout. And so I was one of those people that, you know, I would give you my keys. I'd say, don't let me take the keys from you. And then I would, you know, bully the person, whatever poor person took my keys, I'd bully them into giving me my keys, and so on and so forth. And so eventually, you know, I didn't really last too long along those lines, you know, and my home got taken away. You know, I had to get it out of the impound, and that was all my money there. And so long story short, you know, I came back. I had been exposed to AA before, and I came back once again, tail between my legs. I remember it was a hot summer day on July 17th, 2010. I was confused. I thank God, you know, those walls were down. You know, a drunk who's not done drinking, they have these walls up and you can't get through. You know, it's like, I know, you know, people will ask me, like, why aren't you willing to get sober? It's like, I'm just not, you know, and there's nothing you can say or do to convince me that, you know, that I could change, you know, there's no way that someone could say something to change my mind, right? And so finally, you know, my walls were down just enough to remember that AA was there, right? And, you know, when I was like 16 years old, you know, I would come around meetings. I didn't really take anything seriously. We were at this church. I would, you know, me and my friends would throw lemons and pine cones at each other outside, smoke cigarettes, and, you know, talk smack to each other. But I, in the back of my mind, I knew that AA was there, and even though I was acting like a jackass while I was there, I knew, you know, people didn't, you know, kick me out, tell me I wasn't welcome, and so that seed was planted. And so when the time came where I was ready to come back, I came back to the rooms, and a friend of mine called me, and she said, I have someone to sponsor you, you should give this guy a call. I gave him a call. I started taking steps with this guy, and you know, I was really gung-ho about it, and I was, you know, desperate to stay sober. But, you know, certainly I got to my fourth step, and I was one of those people that my sponsor didn't threaten to dump me if I didn't finish it in 2 weeks. And so I was, you know, caught in fourth step limbo, which I would not recommend to anybody, but I was there for, you know, a solid 8 months. And, you know, what would happen is I'd get miserable, and then I'd do a bunch of work, and I'd get miserable, and I'd do a bunch of work. And then finally, you know, I finished this four step, which was just ridiculously, probably unnecessarily long, but I was told to do a fearless and thorough job, and that's what I did, even though it just took me longer than it probably should have. But, you know, I ended up continuing and going through the process, and, you know, I reached a point in my sobriety where certain behaviors that weren't even present when I was drinking had, you know, come into effect after I sobered up, right? And extremely selfish, hurt a lot of people, and it didn't catch up with me until, you know, after I had gotten to step 9 and I was making amends while I was causing emotional damage to people. And, you know, I used to say, and this used to be true for me, that, you know, the beautiful thing about AA is you can screw up as many times as you want, and you can, at least you have a program that you can, you know, get yourself out of the hole with, so to speak. But that's not the case for me. The road's narrowing, and, I can't get away with being selfish anymore, you know, especially for an extended period of time. You know, the longer I stay around here, I just can't walk, especially having not taken a drink, causing damage to other people, you know, leaving damage in my wake. Because then I start picking up untreated alcoholism, and it seems like there's just too much work to do. And, you know, I've alienated a bunch of people. And so I can't live on Duncan's Anonymous. It just doesn't work for me. Anyway, you know, there have been some ups and downs in my recovery. There have been some really high points, and there have been some really, really, really low points. And, you know, without going too far into that, you know, it brings me up to the way things are now. And, you know, steps 10 and 11 have been the two steps that when I was away in San Diego, I really needed to put those into practice because I didn't have the fellowship to kind of lean back on, right? And I had one of those vital spiritual experiences that the book talks about, you know, at 4.5 years clean and sober. And, you know, it was that point that my cornerstone was fixed in place, you know, and I did not doubt there was a higher power, you know. From that point on, you know, it's just been an ongoing process of really, you know, building a relationship with this power greater than myself. And, you know, and revising my conception of that power as I come to understand it a little bit more as I kind of stumble along. But yeah, I'm so grateful to be here, you know, and I loved the drive up, and, you know, just grateful to have friends and, you know, a lot of drunks like me in the same room. So that's it. Thank you.
And And now I will turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Sarah.
Can I pass anything?
No.
Okay. Great job. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
I feel so professional with this microphone setup. Okay. Yeah. So thank you so much for asking me to speak tonight. I'm really grateful to be here. although, to be 100% honest, driving up, like, I was talking to my friends about how I have a lot of anxiety about speaking right now. And I'm not totally in a place in my sobriety where I'm, like, super proud of, you know, and, like, want to share and talk about for 40 minutes in a room of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who know, like, I hate to use, like, who know the tools of the program that are available to us, you know. So my sobriety date is January 10th, 2011. I was 19 when I came into these rooms. I've never had a legal drink of alcohol. I hope it stays that way. You know. Oh. I feel like that's like a total agreement that I should not drink again or something. Okay, so moving on. So, when I came into these rooms, like, I did not believe I was an alcoholic, you know. When you get sober at 19 and I grew up in Mountain View, it's kind of hard to get your hands on alcohol. Like, it happens. There's ways to do it, you know. But I found other things to do. Drugs are a part of my story. And I found it really difficult to identify with all these things that I heard about of, like, you know, getting DUIs and getting arrested and getting kicked out, losing jobs and families and all these things, you know, because those things never happened to me. Granted, like, I didn't have a lot to lose other than my own respect and, like, the people's respect around me, and I lost that. You know, I sat in these chairs and I just thought to myself, like, that this isn't true. Like, I'm not an alcoholic. You know, my dad has 10 years sober and is the program, and, like, I saw how alcoholism affected our household, and it wasn't until I got older, or it wasn't until, like, I gained more time in sobriety that I realized how similar our behaviors was. You know, that was one of my cop-outs, was that, like, oh, I'm not an alcoholic because, like, I didn't behave the way my dad behaved. But then, like, as my mind got more clear, as I started working the steps, as I got to really look and evaluate the choices and actions that I made while drinking, I started to see the pattern of, like, putting, you know, myself before everybody else, like, wanting to change but not really knowing how. You know, those promises, those, like, empty promises of, like, I'm not going to do it again. Like, I'm so sorry. I love you, whatever it is. And then that not being the case the next day, you know. So I get here, and I didn't identify. You know, I didn't see myself as an alcoholic, and it wasn't until about 3 months, maybe 4 months, sitting in these rooms, like, you know, I can't think of a better word than grace that I got to stay sober for those 3-4 months, not doing much work, that I stayed here. And eventually, like, I saw, like, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I belong here, you know, and 5 years later, like, I'm here. So I'm not one of those people that believe or preach that if you don't think you're an alcoholic, like, go test the theory. I think it's very easy to discover whether or not you're an alcoholic by sitting in these rooms and choosing or not choosing to, you know, apply the solution. Like, I'm fucking miserable if I'm not applying the solution. You know, I'm lonely, I'm depressed, I'm angry, I'm self-centered, like, I want to die. And the other times in my life that I've truly wanted to die was before I found drugs and alcohol, and when drugs and alcohol were taken away from me, you know. So backing up a little bit, you know, I mentioned my dad's in the program. I definitely don't think that, like, growing up in an alcoholic household made me an alcoholic. I think that was a catalyst to me starting to get loaded at 12, 13 years old. I had a great him who was 16, was waking up with the shakes if he wasn't drunk, you know. I don't think that's what made me an alcoholic. I think it was a catalyst in many ways. you know, I am what I am, like, and that's an alcoholic. Like, there's nothing more to it, and it doesn't really matter what made me an alcoholic. It just matters that, like, I can accept that to a certain extent, accept it enough to do the work, right? You know, at the beginning of these 5 years sober, like, I was walking a fine line of, like, going back and forth, like, am I really an alcoholic? And I'm not going to lie, like, sometimes that thought crosses my mind. But, like, when my sponsor asked me what's different, like, why do you think you're an alcoholic? Why do you not think you're an alcoholic now? And then the next minute you do think you are, like, what are the things that are different? The answer is, like, when I'm not in the middle of the herd, when I'm not a part of service, and when I'm not working my steps, you know, when I'm not keeping that conscious contact with God, that's when all of a sudden I become not an alcoholic. You know, and when that was first brought to my attention, like, you know, that's when, like, I felt more hope, you know? So the first time I got loaded, I'm jumping around a little bit. I apologize. I'm nervous. The first time I got loaded, I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school and I went to a senior party, and I thought it was going to be super awesome and cool. And I specifically remember having one drink. It was vodka and orange juice. And the next morning I woke up in my parents' bed, and I wasn't supposed to stay there that night. You know, like, I had told a friend, my parents, that I was staying at my friend's house and she was staying at my house, you know, and all these things. But I woke up with that, like, really quiet lack of sound in the house of, like, fuck, what happened last night? You know, why am I here? What went wrong? And I was terrified, you know, and my parents sat me down and they told me the night before that my eyes had been rolling in the back of my head and that I was foaming at the mouth. And I was completely belligerent and they were terrified and didn't think I was going to make it through the night. And that they thought I might have an allergy to alcohol. And I was entering high school, and the word allergy to me, like, I associated it with, like, a peanut allergy, you know, and that it's deathly and, like, all these things, right? And so I was super bummed out that I was entering high school with this so-called allergy to alcohol, you know, like, all these thoughts that I had about, like, how high school is going to be so great and, like, parties and drinking and doing all these cool things that you see in the movies, like, all of a sudden, like, wasn't going to apply to me, you know? And I was scared. Like, I was scared of not knowing what had happened to me. I was scared of what my parents had said to me. I was scared of the consequences of though you're grounded forever and we're always going to check and call where you're staying the night from now on. I was scared. And then 3 months went by and I took a hit out of a bong for the first time. And I got really paranoid and someone handed me a beer and said, drink this, you'll feel better. And I drank it and I felt better, you know, and that paranoia went away. And that fear of, like, oh my God, if you touch alcohol to your mouth, you're going to die, went away. And so that meant it was time to go, you know. And so, you know, I talked about earlier how it was difficult for me to identify as an alcoholic. And I think what made it so difficult for me was that I jumped around so much throughout my drinking and using, you know, like, I started smoking weed and drinking and that was always kind of there, you know, and then, someone showed me this awesome stuff called Blow and I loved it and it was awesome. And then people started noticing that I was dropping weight way too fast. And so, you know, I kind of got caught and I had to, like, stop that. And I was like, oh, that's a problem. Can't do that anymore, you know? And then I was introduced to raves and ecstasy and I started doing that. And then I overdosed several times. And so I was like, can't do that anymore, you know? And that's the cycle. Like, you know, it didn't matter what it was. Something came up, it got out of control. I found something else that got the same job done, you know? And what it was about for me was as soon as I was with this group of people and we were all, like, I want to say on the same level, but the reality is I was on a different level. But I thought we were on the same level, you know? And, like, I just felt a part of, like, I felt okay, you know, I felt important, like, I felt these bonds were amazing and all these things, you know, and then, like, I'd sober up and I'd be back at my parents' house in my room and I was just miserable, You know, like, I really just wanted to die. Like, I hated myself. Whatever problem it could be, whether it was, like, they didn't like me, I didn't like me, he didn't like me, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not skinny enough, like, it just didn't matter. Like, it was all, like, unbearable, and, like, I wasn't able to deal with it, you know? Like, the AA jargon, the book talks about, like, I could not deal with life on life's terms. And I had to get loaded in order to do so. And it's really wonderful how the magic of the program, when saying that out loud in front of a group of alcoholics, reminds you, like, yeah, that's why you're a fucking alcoholic. Like, that's why you belong in these rooms. You know, that's what ensures our sobriety, is working with other alcoholics. So, you know, a couple ODs later, a couple concerned talks with my parents later, it was time to graduate high school. And, you know, my parents sat me down and told me, like, we don't really have all the funds to send you where you want to go out of state. We think you should stay at home. And I was like, Chico State's really cheap. Let's go there. So I ended up in Chico for 3 months, and then I came home. It's like that whole, like, I think about how I wasn't an alcoholic, right? Because I didn't drink all the time, and, you know, no paper bags and under bridges and stuff. And then, like, just recently I remembered that I totally drank under a bridge in Santa Cruz one time. And, like, in Chico, we drank out of bags all the time. So I hit those qualifications. But, you know, things spiraled really, really fast. And I had, like, a nervous breakdown, and I came home, and I was a mess, and nobody knew what was going on. I didn't know what was going on. My parents were terrified. My sister was terrified. I had lost a majority of my friends at this point. And eventually I was 51-50, and I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And I find it super pertinent to talk about this, and I don't view it as an outside issue, because I was given medications, and I was told that if you continue to drink and use on these medications, they will not work, and you will end up back in the psych ward, you know, and my response to that was, I want to talk to another doctor. And, you know, I kept getting the same answers, but eventually, like, I started hearing different responses, which was like, maybe, we don't know, you know. So, like, a few months after I got diagnosed, like, at this point, because I didn't know how to make friends without getting loaded with them, you know, unless I could invite you to smoke a blunt with me, or to go play beer pong with me, or go to a party with me, or do blow with me. Like, I didn't know how to connect with you. Like, I didn't feel I had anything to offer. So, you know, a few months into, like, trying not to drink and just being so miserable, back to that place of wanting to die, I threw in the towel, and, like, I met up with my friends, and I started getting loaded, and in less than a year, I was back in the psych ward, you know, because that's where I end up. And I 51-50'd myself that time, and I remember coming to in the El Camino Hospital psych ward with this, like, gut wrenching pain, and ran to the toilet and was just, like, vomiting up bile. And I'm sitting down on there, or lying down, like, you know, face on the cold ground and, like, body on the warm, weird carpet. And, like, just thinking, like, how did I get here? You know, like, how am I back? Why is this, why me? You know, if I just weren't bipolar, everything would be okay. That was the problem. So, you know, I get out of there, and my parents tell me, like, if you come home, we're drug testing you, and we're not hanging out. You're not hanging out with your old friends. If they want to come hang out with you, they're going to hang out at our house. And I was like, no, none of my friends want to do that, because we can't get loaded here. So, like, that's not going to work. And I had this, like, social worker lady who was told me about this place I could go live in, and there was other women, and she thinks that she could get my parents to agree to let me stay there. And I was like, sweet, sign me up. I don't care. I want to do it. Turned out that place was a sober living environment, and I had no idea. And so the requirements of that place was I was still getting drug tested. My friends couldn't go over there, and I couldn't go over to my friend's house either. And I had to go to 6 meetings a week, and I had to get a sponsor, and I had to start doing my steps and get a job or do community service, like, you know, all these things. And so, you know, this brings me back to being like 19 years old, sitting in these rooms, just being like, what the fuck? Like, I'm not supposed to be here, you know, and just fighting it. Like, right before the second 5150, the other him got locked, went to jail, and I was writing to him, and I was trying to post his bail, and we were going to run away together, and everything was going to be wonderful. And like, I was going to be a mob wife, and it was going to be great, you know, those were my plans. And, like, Alcoholics Anonymous was a terrible idea. You know, so when it comes down to, like, what the whole, like, God's will thing is, or, like, what's the right will and what's my will, like, I just go back to that very moment in time when my will was to set someone's bail and run away with them. And, like, the will of the universe, God's will, whatever you want to call it, was to sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and get the solution from the 12 steps and live the life I'm living today. You know, so like anytime it comes down to like a him or a job or a fight or a her, like whatever it can be, like I just think of that, like maybe I don't know what's best, just maybe. And that works for me. Like it works really, really well. So, you know, 3 months into the room, being in the rooms, I'm miserable. I don't know how to function. I don't know how to talk really. Like, I was the kid that walked in the rooms and everybody was like, we don't think she's going to make it. And I'm sitting in my home group and someone's talking and I have no idea what they're talking about, but I'm sitting there thinking, like, you know, okay, obviously smoking weed takes me to the psych ward and, like, hard drugs are kind of frowned upon, but, like, drinking, like, I can get away with just drinking on the weekends. You know, like, it's okay. And then I had this thought cross my mind, and, like, God conscious, like, miracle thought, whatever you want to call it. It was like, if you're not an alcoholic, why is it so important to you that you figure out a way to drink so badly? And it was the most terrifying thought. And I just started bawling. And I tried to leave that meeting as fast as I could. But I was surrounded by women who wouldn't let me. And it wasn't that I hit the ground running after that point at all, like, you know, but it was a moment of clarity. Like it was a moment for me and it was amazing and I'll never forget it. You know, so I start working with the sponsor and we do the first step and the best I can manage is maybe my life's unmanageable and, maybe I'm an alcoholic. You know, but that was my 100% at the time, and that kept me sober. So if it's just a maybe for you, like, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, 3 weeks ago, it was a maybe for me. You know? That's the reality of alcoholism. It's like, our disease is trying to take us out. Our disease is trying to kill us. Our disease is trying to get us loaded in whatever way possible. You know, I do this, like, maybe first step, and I get to my second step, and somehow I'm not convinced that I'm insane, even though I've been to the psych ward twice in 1 year, but, like, it was still kind of up for debate. You know, and I'm trying to figure out this third step on, like, how to make it perfect and what it means to turn my will over, and I don't even know what that looks like or what it means, but I do the reading and... you know, basically what I'm trying to say is, like, other than just writing everything down on my fourth step and reading it to my sponsor for my fifth step, like, I had no idea what I was doing up until probably, like, ninth, maybe tenth step the first time around. Like, I just did what I was told. It was as simple as that, you know? And so, like, all those cliches of, like, wait for the magic to happen and, you know, I don't know, the rest of them. Like, that's like, it's the truth. And I hate that they're the truth, but, like, it is true. You know, and they're becoming so much more apparent to me, like, recently, like, one day at a time, really, like, just today. Like, I just need to stay sober today, and I'll trip about tomorrow. But right now, this is all that matters. You know, and by the time I was in between my sixth and my seventh step, my sponsor stopped answering the phone. But what had happened is I had got involved with this young people's group, I also moved up into Sonoma at some point, but SICKYPAW, Santa Clara County Young Peoples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got into service, you know, and it was this rowdy group of, young adults, just young people and, you know, everybody. And, you know, like we learned about traditions, like we sat in the business meetings and we built resentments and then we ran to our same circle that like we were all sponsored by and like figured out like how to get over these resentments. And like, we were so fortunate. I didn't grow up sober in any other area than San Jose, but like, I am so grateful for the people who came before me in that town. You know, the people that got sober at 19 and 20 and 25 and, you know, had like 15, 20 years sober when I was still struggling, you know, at 19 years old and whatever, and coming to them and just being like, sweetheart, like, we made that mistake. Like, you're okay. You're going to survive. It's going to be okay. You know, like, don't get too mad at them. Like, they're going to save your ass later on. And it's true. And it's happened. You know, and those people that, like, there's always that one person or the multiple people that, like, you do not want to be caught dead in a room with because you hate them that much. maybe it's just me. I don't know. But, like, you know, eventually, like, we grow up together. Like, we walk through sobriety together. And those people have saved me. Like, they've really saved me. Like, I've gotten to save them. Like, it's fucking rad. So I told myself when I first got sober, someone told me to give it a year, and I thought a year was a really long time. And I couldn't control how fast a year went by, but I could control how fast I worked the 12 steps. And I was like, I'll work the 12 steps. Like, and by that time, if I'm done and I don't like it, then I'll leave. And they're like, okay, like, sounds great. Good plan. You know? So instead of like doing this whole, I'm just going to give it a year. Like, I decided to, you know, do the 12 steps. And like I said, by the sixth step, when my sponsor stopped answering the phone, like, I was eager. Like, I wanted more, you know? I got a taste of what it was like to like make friends, and feel like I had something to offer that wasn't like weed or alcohol, you know? I got to have like real conversations with people. Like, you know, I got to like really learn some rad things about myself. Some things not so rad, but like, I got to learn how to correct them to the best of my ability, or just maybe accept them depending on what they were. At 2.5 years, like, I moved to Santa Rosa, and it was, an experience. You know, I was stripped from my fellowship. I was stripped from my sponsor, who I called so damn much, she knew what I was eating for breakfast. You know, and I was stripped from like the meetings that like I regularly attended, and I really had to rely on my connection with a higher power. And what it looked like when I moved back from Santa Rosa was sitting on the front porch with that sponsor being like, I don't know what to do. And she was like, well, you're either going to get drunk or you're going to start working the steps again. You know, it's as simple as that. And it is that simple. It's not necessarily that easy, but it's that simple, you know? And like, my sobriety ebbs and flows. Like, that's my honesty, you know? Like, 4 months ago, I was meditating every morning and like doing a 10th step at night without being told, and like, you know, trying to get to meetings as much as possible while, you know, taking a full load at school and like working and, you know, doing life and all this shit. And like, today, like, I watch Netflix instead of meditate. And I'm not proud of it. Like, I would love to be able to come up here and tell you how, like, I'm kicking ass at my sobriety, but like, I don't really feel that. The best that I can do is like, be honest, you know, like, I work in the service industry, at this great restaurant, and, I'm around classy drinkers all the time. And I was not one of those. Like, I thought just buying a $9 bottle of wine made me a classy drinker, you know, because it was wine, so it's classy. And, like, it's hard sometimes, you know? Like I said, when my sponsor asked me what was different, like I said, I'm not in the middle of, you know, the fellowship. And, like, I check in with my girls, but, like, the beautiful thing when you grow up in sobriety, like, people have kids and people have families and people go in this direction and that direction and move for job opportunities and wonderful things. And a friend of mine told me not too long ago, he has like 30 years sober or something. And he always says sobriety equals dreams. And we were talking about how, like, the longer you stay sober, like, the path gets more and more narrow. You know, the possibilities are endless, but the path is narrow. And that really, like, registers for me, you know, because it's for, like, 5 years since my last drink is a while. You know, it's easy for me to be like, oh, it wasn't that bad. Like, it's easy for me to take credit for the wonderful things in my life today. And I don't want to be that one that slips away. You know, I've watched it happen. About a month and a half ago, I got a phone call that him I was going to bail out of jail was driving the car with his girlfriend at the time, and she was in the rooms with us for a while, you know, and they crashed and she died. And he's doing time. And, like, that's where my life would have taken me. On the drive up here, like, my friend and I were talking about, you know, if that one person doesn't, you know, change, like, they're not going to make it. They're going to die. And, like, that's the reality of it. You know, like, this disease takes people out. Like, it kills us. And it sucks. Like, it'd be super rad if I could drink normally and not have to worry about a disease that's trying to fucking kill me. But I have this. You know, I have the 12 steps that Alcoholics Anonymous offers me. I have the fellowship that Alcoholics Anonymous offers me. I have the connection with myself, with something greater than myself that Alcoholics Anonymous offers me. And I'm really grateful for that. Like, yeah, that's a sufficient substitute for me. And sometimes I get so stuck in my own head and my own ways that, like, I don't see it that way. And I just look at what other people are doing with impunity, as the book says, you know, and I want to be like them. But I'm not. Sobriety is not always easy. Like, it's not. But neither is life, really. Like, so, I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things. Like, I just stay sober for today. You know, and, like, that's really all that I can do. Like, and the different things that keep me sober at sometimes, like, sometimes it's just ego and pride. Like, that's it. Like, sometimes it's because, like, I want to be that person with 20 years in the meeting, you know? And, like, sometimes it's pure logic, right? Like, the risk of sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous being, like, on the fence of whether or not I'm an alcoholic is a hell of a lot safer than being out there testing the theory. You know, trying to sit down to my parents and explain to them why I don't identify as an alcoholic anymore and why they shouldn't worry that, you know, I'm drinking now after all the, you know, like, the day that my mom told me, and it was one of those conversations where she was looking at me but looking past me because she was just so lost in memory of, like, how grateful she was that she didn't jump every time she heard a creak in the house, terrified that the phone was going to be ringing, telling her that something was wrong with me. You know, like, I remember the relief that was told to me when I had about 9 months sober and, like, the obsession to drink first came back for the very first time. And someone told me, like, that's not something you need to be ashamed of. Like, you're an alcoholic. It's normal. And when those thoughts first started coming back for me earlier this year, you know, my sponsor sat me down and she asked me, like, did you recoil from alcohol like it was a hot flame? And I had to sit there and I had to really think of it, you know, like, we had this conversation after this training I had at work where we were learning about, like, these, like, fancy whiskeys. I don't know. But we sell them at my job. And, I had this thought cross my head and it's fucking insanity, you know, but that's what this disease is. That, like, God, it really sucks that I'm an alcoholic. Like, well, maybe if I just killed myself, I'd come back and I wouldn't be an alcoholic in my next life and it'd be totally okay. You know, like, what is that? Like, it's crazy. I really hope someone can relate to that. So, but you know, so I'm sitting there and I'm talking to her and I'm telling her about this. And she asked me, like, did you recoil like it was a hot flame? And, like, I had to think about it, but the reality was yes. You know, yes, I did. Like, the thought of getting loaded does terrify me. You know, and then the next question was, did you immediately turn your attention to helping someone else? And the answer was no. For the last week, these thoughts have been coming up, and I've been calling people and crying and being like, what do I do? You know, and listening to them say, just, you know, keep going, don't drink. And it had to be brought to my attention that, like, I need to turn my attention to the next suffering alcoholic. And, like, maybe just the next suffering individual. Like, I just need to get out of myself. You know, relapse isn't a part of my story. And I'm really, really grateful for that. And I see those people who, like, I was in a midnight meeting not too long ago in San Jose. And, like, I saw someone who relapse is very prevalent in his story. And, you know, that's that work with another alcoholic, like listening to him loaded outside the meeting. Talking about how he wakes up in the morning to listen to Joe and Charlie tapes while drinking Wild Turkey. And he doesn't know if he can go home without killing himself. Like, you know, the room gets silent because we know how true that voice, that thing that says that, is inside all of us as alcoholics. And, yeah, like, I just, I don't know, like I said, like, I'm really grateful that, like, I got to come up here and speak tonight. Like, driving up, my friend and I were talking about, like, where do you find the motivation? Where do you find the motivation when, like, Netflix becomes more of a priority than your step work, than your spiritual maintenance, you know, talking about what it was like. That's what helps for me, you know? Working with another alcoholic, like, yeah, my life is busy today, but, like, it's only busy because, like, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me become the woman that I am today. You know, like, I know how to show up for school today because Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to show up. I know how to ask for help today in school because Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that. Like, same with work, you know, like, yeah, there's times I resent the hell out of this program and this disease, but, like, the bottom line is, like, I really am grateful that I'm here, and I can't, unfortunately, I can't imagine growing up any other way, and I'm really grateful that this is the place that I've grown up. You know, and I hope I can continue to grow up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.